Good morning and welcome, everybody. Good to have you back here with us, and I hope you enjoy the conversation we just had. We taped that conversation because with Rob Rehmeyer from Oak Park. After we had Barbara Samuels on the program, and I asked Barbara Samuels, do you have examples of places around the country where there was actual racial and economic integration into communities that were being developed? And she suggested a talk with him, which we did. There are many, many issues involved here as we lead up to the Port Covington hearings on Wednesday night, which take place in Councilman Crossoak's committee. And we'll be covering it this coming Wednesday. We'll be covering it Thursday. Apparently, the president of the city council has, we just learned, moved the hearing date, moved the vote date, excuse me, from August the 28th up to August the 8th, pushing it up till there's a vote. And so this is, we have a unique opportunity now here in Maryland, in Baltimore especially, to wrestle with how we want to develop our city. What do we want it to look like? Where does this money go if there's public investment? We've asked two guests to come join us in this half hour to think about what was just heard and how that relates to where we are now and how do we make things change. Patrick Mayer is Executive Director of the Innovative Housing Institute. Good. Welcome to the studio. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here, Mark.
Also joining us by phone is Dr. Maricela Gomez, who is a physician, community activist, and author of Race, Class, Power, and Organizing in East Baltimore, Rebuilding Abandoned Communities in America. Maricela, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Nice to be with you all.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can email us to talk@steinershow.org. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner, but do join us. Go on our Facebook pages, 410-319-8888. I was reading an article by Roberto Alejandro earlier today that he puts out on the web where he wrote that between 2012 and 2016, there was a 30% increase in millionaire homes in Baltimore. 35% in Silver Spring, and way off the charts in D.C. and New York. And we are, I think, on the cusp, Maricela, of the very same thing with this Port Covington deal. I wonder how you think what the proposition in Oak Park has to say to us.
Well, I think it's a wonderful model, and the outcomes speak volumes for what the intention was. But the outcomes and the evaluation of the model present day gives us a lot of information that was shared already. But I think for me, when I listened, what I heard was the idea of an intentional community, the idea and the practice of an intentional community, and the integration as the basis of what that intentional community was about. And I think if we in Baltimore could get there, that would be huge. So it's a challenge, right? And
yeah.
We have to talk about the challenge so that we can figure out, given those challenges, how we would move about to make that happen, how we would move about making something like what happened in Oak Park be something we could do in Baltimore. And I think to not talk about the political will here in Baltimore, we would be missing a point. We would be, in a way, putting the cart before the horse, so to speak, because I think what I would like to hear about the Oak Park was, what was the political will? Who were the players? How organized was the community?
Hmm.
When I hear that the city council has moved the date up for the voting, what that tells me is we're going against the political will that wants to do anything around integration, that wants to do anything around intentional diversity or intentional inclusivity or any type of living where we would move Baltimore away from becoming even more segregated and marginalizing our most vulnerable.
Patrick Mayer.
Thank you, Mark. I think Maricela has made some very, very positive points that I largely agree with. I think Oak Park and the great story that we was just shared really demonstrated that political will was at the core of what resulted in Oak Park becoming an intentional community that wanted to foster integration and diversity. The story of the Baltimore area doctor whose home was firebombed and how that brought an outpouring of I'll say empathy and support and 300 households got together and said, this is not our town, demonstrated the political will expressed by the people at that point in time. I think that political will, in terms of a commonality, a common vision, is something that we're a long ways from here in Baltimore. And I would say the very precipitate move towards adopting the vision of the Newport Covington demonstrates that our leaders are not open to the deep discussion that needs to be had at this very important development of regional impact.
So I think it's a question of political will and how you make things happen, and also the continuing argument about the economics of it, how you build a community that is racially and economically mixed, and how you build a community maybe Port Covington is like the rest of Baltimore, and it's developed as a majority African American community inside the city of ours, rather than being what it's about to be, which is a wealthy, mostly white enclave, and how you do that. And I think that we are right on the precipice here of being able to do something incredible, but I think that the opposite seems to be happening in terms of whether the political will is there on the many people's parts. Political will is not there on our political and business leaders' ends. And I want to open the phone to you, Marisol. Would you give a quick thought on that? I mean,
yeah, I do, Mark, because I think we can't separate out political will and economy too much, because in reality, we're living in a society where they're the same, meaning that the political will is driven by the economy.
Right.
Right? So we have a government that has been completely taken over by private interests. I mean, we can't get away from those kinds of discussions, because our local leadership have basically decided that the people with the most money in the city and in the state should tell them what to do, should tell them what is in the benefit and the best interest and the public good of the people. So the political will is really the private interest will. And I think the more we come to just name that and say basically that that's what we have private interest running government in the guise of people who we say we as the people elect. We don't have a government that represents the people. We have a government that represents private interests. Let's talk about that, because that's the political will and that's the economy right there. Because that's what, you know, when we move a hearing where that hearing date would give us more ample time for the people to organize, so we can bring more people to the table, so we can get help that misinformation that was just talked about, help bring that information to the fore, help get around these misperceived understandings of the fact that we're not segregated. We need that time to bring the knowledge base somewhere similar, so people can get on board and we can organize people to push that leadership, that push that political and the capital leadership, right? When you move a date like that, what you're saying basically is we're not interested in the public becoming informed, becoming knowledgeable, questioning their biases, so we can have a more even playing field and so we can have a more honest dialogue, a more honest exploration of how do we change this currently segregated, racist, economically segregated, everything that we're talking about on this radio show. So we have to just call it what it is. We can maintain compassion, but we have to talk truth. We have to talk truth to the power. But right now we are in the midst of a government that is run by the private interests of our city and our state.
So the question is, Rob, I do want to get the phone to people calling in when they get their ideas here. But Patrick, I mean, so what? And you've been working in this area a long time. So what when you have kind of a political array of developers and others kind of lined up against any idea of creating an inclusive community, what have you seen done that changes that paradigm?
Yeah, I would say, first of all, I'll differ with Marisol a little bit, the economics of making a deal like Port Covington happen are valid and real. I think developers face real challenges in terms of raising money. I think, however, the ability to put together a financial structure that incorporates more of the public needs and public benefits is very real, and it's something that I've seen done and time again around the country. Relatively recently in Chicago, we were expert consultants to the city of Chicago. As they revamped their inclusionary housing law, they put together a 45-member citizen, developer, public sector task force to examine the existing law, to look at all of its wrinkles and issues, and it had some, and to then make recommendations that would serve the community better. Ultimately, Mayor Emanuel adopted these recommendations. The law has been reenacted, and it's much stronger law now in Chicago. And part of what has to happen is serious economic analysis about the cost of development, the cost of including affordable housing, what levels the housing can serve. All of that has to happen, and it has to be realistic, because if it's unrealistic, fundamentally, developers, which are the driving force for this housing, are not going to build there. So it has to be something that is a serious evaluation. I'll say, on the other hand, it's important, though, and this is where political will comes in. In the case of Chicago, it wasn't, are we going to have an inclusionary housing law? That wasn't the premise. Rahm Emanuel said, we've got a law. It's a weak law. We really need to make it better. And the developers came to the table because they want to be part of that marketplace in Chicago. The same thing is true in Baltimore. Baltimore has a strong marketplace. Port Covington is a high opportunity area. Developers who are clearly given the message that incorporating these public benefits is critical will figure out a way to make that happen. And I'll say the city needs to come to the table with all of the benefits and subsidies that they are able to bring to bear.
So let me open the phones here. I'm going to come right back to it, because I'd like to know more specifically about just what's in that law. I mean, does the city pay for the inclusionary housing? What percentage is in there, those two things?
In Chicago?
Yeah.
No. It's largely driven by density bonuses that are granted to developers in Chicago.
What does that mean, density bonuses?
Density bonus simply means that for a given parcel of land, the developer is able to add units, to build more units than he would have been able to under the base density. So typically, they'll be able to build 20% more units on the same piece of land. That adds to their value because a fraction of them are affordable and some are market as well.
So what does affordable mean, and how many houses are there in development? What percentage?
Typically, the requirement varies depending on the location within the city. They actually did a very smart thing, was they looked at the whole of Chicago and said, inside the Loop, for example, we've got extremely high values, high rises where condominiums are selling for $500,000 and up. Other parts of the city are weak and really need investment. They gave developers the option to contribute to an affordable housing trust fund and to provide units on site. And it has a little bit of a Chinese menu quality in terms of whether they build more units on site, there's less money that has to be contributed. So it is it's not a one-word answer in terms of the requirement is.
So it's that. Let me open the phone to you, Marisol. I'll come right back to you. I'm going to give a couple callers in here very fast. We'll come right back to you at 410-319-8888. Michael Scott, you're on the air. How you doing, Michael?
I'm doing great. It's great conversation. Both colleagues are on different ends of the spectrum of work. Within Maricela and Patrick, both great people. And I think some of the solutions that they have both lifted up are absolutely needed, and we need to put our foot on the gas a little for Baltimore. I mean, I think where they tie together for me is imagination. I mean, we live in a marginal change state that, we had a caller on last week that was a pastor of a historic pulpit who was challenging his moral imagination, right? And saying, well, you know, here's what deals will get done. It's we can only move so far. And I just think that's wrong. And you know, we have real data that supports a counter argument. And it's incontrovertible data. It's Manuel Pastor's new work on equity, growth, and community, and looking at 300 metropolitan areas across the country. And it is you can't argue with that econometric data and the storytelling, which really says that the communities that are most sustainable, that are growing the best, have the greatest equity, because we've shifted in demographics, we've shifted in what business leaders are starting to understand needs to be toward conscious capital, and so even in instances where there's top down business leadership or top down government leadership, or in places where there's great conflict, like Fresno and San Antonio, if you can develop a shared vision that's a common vision, even if we don't agree on everything, that's what moves it forward. But without what Maricela talked about, specifically anti-racism principles, you can develop an epistemology that is, you know, makes more skillful racism. Right? And I mean, so, or the impact of racism, if we don't have a structural analysis and lens and act like we understand business and develop a common language. And I think we can do that, but we have yet to do that in Maryland. And it's part of the work I'm doing at Equity Matters and part of the Opportunity Coalition and Collaborative that I'm interested in seeing promulgate. And it has roots in best practices that you cannot argue with because the data is there.
All right, Michael, look forward to having you on the show. We can talk more specifically about what that data is and what it really says. That's what I want to know. I think that's what our listeners want to know. And let's go to Gary in Baltimore City. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks, Mark, for taking my call. And I know Dr. Maricela Gomez a little bit. I don't know your other guests. But my perspective, I guess, is kind of extreme. It kind of incorporates John Trudell speaking in the words of Crazy Horse, where he says, would you sell the land? The land is our mother. Would you sell the air? Would you sell the stars? And in saying those words, I'm trying to get us to a place in the future where I hope that, you know, everybody has a home, and, you know, there's a lot of egalitarianism and whatnot. I'm sure that Maricela Gomez and myself agree on more things than we disagree, most definitely. I haven't read her book yet, even though I have an autographed copy. But she spoke of the, you know, the area around Johns Hopkins as the Middle East, and that was an on-purpose analogy because the oligarchs and the plutocrats tend to have sway in a capitalist paradigm. And at some point, we have to realize, because it is such a vulturistic system, that it has to be cast to the wayside of history. I don't expect it to be done tomorrow, but, you know, these are very tumultuous times, and we have to figure out how to do it maybe within the next 100 years. And I need, you know, I'm oh. sorry, we need to have more revolutionary thought within our discussions. And thank you for your time. I'll take your comments off the air.
Gary, thanks. Maricela, let me let you jump back in, and then we'll come back to Patrick Mayer. I mean, I think I know the exact quote he was talking about, of John Trudell's quotes. But if you start out as a premise that's the belief you hold, and you're facing the reality of Baltimore City and the demographic, and who owns Port Covington's land now, where do we take this? I mean, you know, you could just say, okay, look, let me just say for this, this is the third largest TIF in American history that Port Covington's getting. Third largest TIF in the whole country. You could just say to them, forget the TIF, develop it yourself, do what you want. But with our public money, you have to do certain things. I mean, how do we get there?
Yeah, you know, I think that I think what we wait on sometime is that if everyone gets educated about what equity means, what racial equity means, what economic equity means, that they would do something different. And I think that we've waited a long, long time for that mm-hmm. common understanding and knowledge base to grow. And so when I hear that if our city government and our state government and, you know, federal government in many levels, because they're, you know, they're approving funding, or they didn't really this time, the federal funding for transportation structure. But if we wait for our government leadership to become educated so they can open their eyes and see what their current policies and decision-making is doing to our city, then I think it lies on the understanding that we think that they don't know. And what I would like to share, and what I keep saying, is I think our government knows very well, because it's right around us. I mean, look what happened last year after Freddie Gray. We had all our politicians standing up and saying, yes, we're in a problem. Yes, we're two cities, one black, one white, one poor, one not as poor. So what that told me was people were saying and testifying and witnessing that we know a problem exists. Something violent like that had to happen where a man, another man, black man's life was taken, and the city rose up. And then our politicians and our political figures and our city leaders, if we want to call them that, people with money, they all stood up and said, yes, you're right, we have to do something. Now, 1 year later, and look what we're doing again in light of that. It's all context, right? So what I'm saying is that our government leaders are well aware that we have a big problem, and they're well aware of how we came to have this problem. They were all articulating it very well last year. A year later, they've kind of forgot that knowledge base, and now their knowledge base is back to what capital is telling them to do. So given that, what it means is that the people, which it's always been, power never changes without people organizing and demanding change. It never has, it never will. That was a famous quote, right? Frederick Douglass said this. Why do we think that anything has changed? Look at how segregated we are today. So I think if we look at the facts, and we look at where our funding is, and the fact that America is growing more segregated economically everywhere we look, maybe there's some holdouts, maybe there's some places where it hasn't. But by and large, this is where we're at. Look at who is running for president in the Republican Party. When we have a nation that is willing to look at that kind of person as someone who could lead this country, then I think we have to be really aware of where we are today. And so it's with that whole context and that data that I'm speaking and saying that we're living in a time now where capital dictates what public does. Given that, what do we do? Do we have models like Patrick's talking about? Yes, we do. Can we take that? Can we bring that forward? Can the people become educated on that? And can they demand that kind of model? Can we hold up the political process? Can one small thing would be, can we change the hearing to bring it back to the debate that it was? And the justification would be that we have things to do. We have alternative models to put together to meet with you, city council official and state official. And here's the discussion.
Let me, before we run out of time, let me tell Robert Mayer, I think that, but just very quickly, it's not just the hearing, it is the actual vote on Port Covington that the President of City Council, Jack Young, has moved up 3 weeks to give it less time for people to discuss and talk about.
Let me say I share much of Maricela's disappointment and frustration. We worked as part of the Opportunity Collaborative, the group that received a federal planning grant at the Baltimore Metropolitan Council, and produced the Regional Plan for Sustainable Development. It was released last June to a fair amount of fanfare in the governmental sector. It's a plan that actually looks at all of the regional issues: housing, transportation, unemployment, and access to jobs. Very thoroughly done, really a good set of plans. And to go to Maricela's point, there's not a lack of knowledge about the issues in this region and really what need to be done for them, because good strategies came out of that planning process. Now, I'll say the regional governments are largely silent on this issue. This is a huge development of regional impact. And one of the core recommendations of the housing plan, part of that set of regional plans, was the regional governments, all of the surrounding counties around Baltimore City, in addition to Baltimore City, should adopt and strengthen inclusionary housing ordinances. Right there on the plan, it says that all of the governmental representatives were there. And at this point, I'll say that, that there isn't a lack of knowledge. There is deliberate ignorance. And I think at this point, that's very unfortunate for the people of the region.
So, I think the question is where the teeth in that plan are. We've over the years have been a lot of these kind of studies and things going on. It would be good to, when you all come back, is to really explore. What those plans mean, how those plans get implemented when people don't really care.
I fully agree with you. Unless you get the politicians to care about this, and you get them to care about it because you put their jobs at risk, because people are angry and they will vote them out of office if they don't consider these plans and listen to the issues that are being lifted up by the people, but I'll say largely ignored at this point. Part of it is a lack of political strength and coalitions, and we're building one to try to implement these plans, the Opportunity Coalition.
Well, maybe we'll have both you and Maricela back on this Wednesday or Thursday as we make a much larger push on this and in the coming weeks, because this is a very critically important piece. And I want to thank you, Patrick Mayer. Great to meet you, Executive Director of the Innovative Housing Institute, and always important to have with us Dr. Maricela Gomez, who's been fighting this stuff in our community for a long time as a physician and community activist. Maricela, thank you so much as well.
Thank you, Mark, for having this and keeping this on the forefront.
Thank you, Mark.
We won't let it go. We'll be right back. Stay with us. We'll see what's happening in Philadelphia.